Broadcasting from the beautiful Tenderloin in San Francisco, it's the Are You Serious Show.
Are you serious?
I'm Are You Serious, and this is my show. Welcome to show number 8 of the Are You Serious Show. Big number 8. 8 ball. Yeah, I just had an 8 ball, man. I wish. No, I don't really wish. Anyway, last week we promised that the show was going to smash your head in. It was going to be so hard and so tight that there wouldn't be a wasted instant, and it would fuck you up really badly. And apparently that worked, because I haven't heard from anybody all week. So I know that you're tranced out and you're probably institutionalized. But hopefully we have a whole new group of users, listeners, 8-ball freaks.
Victims
of the Are You Serious Show. But we're going to go easy on your head today. We're going to be mellow, because all we have to bring you is anarchy. A journal of desire armed. Mellow, mellow anarchy. With Ben Blue, one of the participants in Anarchy, the magazine, a journal of desire armed. So it's going to be sweet. It's going to be relaxed. And we do have a gang of 3 here with us today, as usual. Jeff Deal, twirling the knobs and speaking when he feels like it. And Diana Brown is back with us.
Delighted.
Hey, glad to have you back.
Welcome. Come right in. You can't afford to miss this. Step right up.
I have to say, I've been focused down on Brazil Way, down by Rio de Janeiro. Some interesting things are going on in that somewhat mellow area. Apparently, the small town of Esperantina, located about 1,300 miles north of Rio de Janeiro, has a new national holiday. The mayor of the town, Felipe Santalia, has endorsed May 9th as a holiday. The holiday, ladies and gentlemen, Orgasm Day.
Woohoo!
Exactly. Now, I think that is the response he was hoping for. Unfortunately, a few
That's
of their residents...
Say
it's good to know. You know, we should actually document what people say during orgasm.
Very nice.
Splendid!
Well done.
Good politics!
Buffo! As long as they don't say mommy. But
Vote
that's a whole
me.
Different show now, isn't it?
I'm elected!
Well, according to the mayor...
A mayoral orgasm.
That's right. And I think the mayor is having a
We're regressing
orgasm.
Here, though. I mean, it was last week it was all about sperm. And
you know, I guess I'm a bit on a topic here. First, we were sorting our sperm for sex. This week, we're celebrating orgasms.
We're spurting our sperm for...
Well, you suggested they taste it last week, and I think that's the ultimate fail-safe to protect the truth of your
that's
family.
True.
But, you know, this guy, he went to his residence, and at first... They were a bit skeptical. It's a very religious area, the town of Esperantina. But what spurred this was a lot of research that he had read saying that mostly women have trouble achieving orgasm, and oddly enough, especially during marriage. So they put this day on. It was May 9th, and it's going to be an annual celebration. And to quote the mayor, he says he's seen scientific studies that show when a woman is unloved, when her husband possibly can bring her to orgasm, well, it affects all aspects of her life. Apparently her relationships, home, city, at work. Basically, the mayor of this town is saying orgasms are good for the world.
So, I mean, he will have to distribute less funds for other things to help people along if his people are happy and healthy. I mean, I can see Orgasm Day being pretty popular in Rio.
Absolutely.
Where, you know, people wander around.
Every day is orgasm.
Every day is orgasm. In Rio.
Now, Brazil, it sounds like you're speaking from personal experience.
I have been there.
I've never been there, actually, but...
it's a little frightening.
My wife was there, and she said that there are women in bikinis in the banks.
They
it
have
sounds
a
like a
completely different
wonderful,
perspective.
Wonderful spot, but this
so.
Small town, Brazil, this sounds like a radical move.
Well, it was, and apparently the
a
residents
very Catholic culture,
very highly religious culture. So this was a particularly unusual idea for them to embrace, but apparently they've warmed to it, and I guess we knew they'd come around.
They've warmed to it.
Creates a gentle warming sensation. No, I've been watching too much
television. Well, I'm sure the women warmed to it. I don't know if the guys are all that happy about the extra, performance anxiety.
Well,
the focus on female orgasms.
Well, right. The focus was on all orgasms, to be fair. They had panel discussions
women,
on...
I mean, guys don't really have a problem with this.
That's pretty much what they decided after their day of celebration.
Yeah, well, orgasm day. What are you,
Orgasm month?
Orgasm hour. So we're here with Ben Blue from the magazine Anarchy, a journal of desire armed. And I got to figure the audience for the Are You Serious show is at various levels of what we might call sophistication or awareness of the idea of anarchism as an actual philosophy as opposed to just something that Beavis painted on Mr. Anderson's garage in an episode, the A in the circle, some people out there take it as a coherent and humane political ideal, and then there, some people will be fully aware of that and know the umpteen different ideological flavors of anarchism. So we have to assume that level of sophistication, and then we have to assume a lot of people who think, oh yeah, those are those guys who go to the anti-globalization demonstrations and throw a few rocks at cops and break a few windows. And in some cases, perhaps both. And then we have your magazine, Anarchy, a Journal of Desire Armed, which seems primarily oriented towards communicating with fairly sophisticated fellow anarchist people who are already involved in the philosophy of anarchism. Do you have much interest in communicating with ordinary Joes about or Jills about anarchy?
Yes.
Anarchism?
Yeah, we do. And I think it's a legitimate criticism of the magazine that...
well, it's not a criticism because it has its own purpose.
I'm about to make my own criticism. In many cases, this magazine is now 25 years old, and as it's developed and has been primarily devoted to an anarchist audience, a certain level of technical jargon and discourse does develop that a newcomer to it can open up the magazine and say, I have no idea what these people are talking about. And one of the things that we are doing with the... there's been a transition of a new publishing group here in the Bay Area. It's been published out of Missouri for the last 25 years. We're attempting to deal with that problem and starting an Anarchy 101 column so that someone with, say, a high school level of education can walk in and begin to pick up threads through the 101 column.
Sort of an Anarchy for Dummies.
Yeah.
That would be nice. Anarchy for Dummies. So how would you describe some of the contemporary trends right now in anarchism? I've read that you guys are associated with post-left, something called post-left anarchism.
And yeah.
How many variations are thriving right now that people take seriously within anarchist circles?
Well, there are a great many varieties. I don't think it's... to quote the point that Christianity is fragmented over the last 2,000 years, but it can sometimes rival that. And anarchy has begun to develop itself as the sort of the vanguard publication, if you will, of post-left anarchist discourse that for people who do take anarchy or anarchism seriously as a political theory, it has developed out of a convergence of liberalism and socialism. And so obviously you have some leftist trends there. And the moniker post-left is an indication that we recognize that these are the historical precedents of current anarchist theory. And many of the people contributing to the magazine today feel that the left, as it has been, has exhausted itself, and that that there really is no point in attempting to ameliorate the excessive cruelties of the institution of the state through various reformist tactics. Some trends in the post-left discourse include going beyond a critique of the state as an institution. You have prominent, the anarcho-primitivist tendency is one. John Zerzan is a frequent contributor to the magazine, and he's recently denounced many people in the staff for still having these tendencies towards leftism. Some of us had a meeting with anti-state communists about a year and a half ago, and he says, "You've got to stop talking with those leftists." And there are others with critiques of, say, the institution of work. Bob Black is a frequent contributor who's probably most famous for his essay on the abolition of work. Yeah. And so these are some of the trends of the discourse that appears in the magazine.
So, I mean, what is the post-left anarchist movement doing to create an anarchist society, or to create a less hierarchical or a non-hierarchical society? What's the strategy here? What do we do here?
Yeah, and that's a really tough question. That I think that there's one of the tendencies within this post-left discourse is to deride a certain other tendencies. Say there's in the New York area, there's the Northeastern Federation of Anarchist Communists, which they call themselves neo-platformists. This refers to back in
their shoes. It refers to their shoes.
It refers to their shoes, yes.
I remember.
Because of the disco era, you know, nice. In the 70s. Now, there's some anarchists in the early part of the century looked at the success of the Bolsheviks and the Russian Revolution and said, well, the anarchists are horribly disorganized, and we need to adopt some of the Leninist organizing strategies, create a platform where we have strategic and tactical unity, and to achieve our ends. And a post-left discourse rejects this, is that people need to begin developing their own strategies and tactics without reference to what other groups are doing. There isn't an organized international anarchist conspiracy. So it can involve any number of tactics. There's the zero work movement, there's tax resistance, there's a lot of propaganda distribution, not much propaganda by the deed these days.
But what do you think of the Black Bloc and their tendency?
Me personally, I tend to find the Black Bloc tactics ineffective.
We'll provide a link to this so people know what we're talking about.
Okay. I think that it's wonderful as a symbolic gesture of throwing rocks at the windows of corporations in downtown Seattle. I don't think that, you know, there's a perception in the media that, well, they'll just go out on a rampage and throw rocks at anything, the mom and pop grocery, just on a rampage of destruction. And I think, no, that the targets that they do select for symbolic purposes, these are multinational corporations that need to be targeted as in part responsible for the perpetuation of a global dystopia. But I think a more effective tactic for black blockers, and of course I'm not advocating that anyone would do this because it's illegal, but I would think that if a lot of them began to become hackers and broke into the banking software and began to redistribute the funds of multinational corporations to, say, homeless advocacy groups, That might be a more effective tactic, but of course I'm not going to advocate.
That would be very well defended in terms of the war on terrorism and so forth. They would be watching that and seeing it. The authorities would be watching that and seeing that in terms of Al Qaeda or something, I would imagine. That's definitely been an area of interest for those of us involved in
that would be interesting.
Techno-culture.
Reroute the funds to, you know, radical Islamist organizations. Discredit the corporations. Of course, you don't get the attachment of the
or make it make it look like
the
make it look like the corporations are,
yeah,
are rooting the funds.
Yeah,
that could be interesting. So Zerzan, John Zerzan, has written a book called Against Civilization. He believes that we should return to the hunter-gatherer type of society. How do we get from here to there?
No, honestly.
Go ahead. Do you agree with him? And
I find Zerzan's writings interesting as a critique of much of what is wrong with the world, and I think he has a very valid point that the origins of cities have led to the development of the state. But I don't feel that at this point, with 6 billion people, we're all going to work our way towards becoming hunter-gatherers again. And I find it mostly interesting as a critique of existing civilization, and I'm sure many green anarchists up in Eugene would disagree with me on this, that, you know, we can get there. And one of the things that we should be doing within the next few issues of Anarchy Magazine, some of us have recently come across the writings of a French geographer from the 19th century, Élisée Reclus, R-E-C-L-U-S. He gave the eulogy at Bakunin's funeral. And so one of my associates in particular, Aragorn, is going to a Reclus conference in New Orleans in October.
A
actually,
that's his real name.
Yes, it's his real name. Reclus, Aragorn sees in Reclus a middle path, and he's going to be devoting his workshop to reclaiming Reclus as a middle path for green anarchists between primitivism and urbanism. We can't get back to hunter-gatherer society, but we can begin to devolve the cities. And so that will be a topic to be explored in future issues of the magazine.
Does that involve some sort of extracting like the more sustainable elements of modern modern, you know, industrial sort of economy and stripping away the excess?
Yeah, I think it certainly would involve some of that. I think you would be looking at permaculture. A lot of what's going on within the green movement, green discourse, without stipulating the need for a state, which is one of the primary differences between the green anarchists and, say, the Green Party. Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a break for a moment to hear some music by Chumbawamba, a self-declared anarchist band, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Line.
Serious. We're back with Ben Blue from the magazine Anarchy, a journal of desire armed. I just want to assure my audience who might not understand some of the references here that we're going to provide a fair amount of links on the homepage so that people can look up some of these names and learn more about them. But I want to get personal with you, man, because you wrote a piece in your magazine, which was pretty interesting. I believe you said that you were schizophrenic.
Yeah, well, I was diagnosed initially with paranoid schizophrenia in 1991, and the diagnosis was altered within a period of about 23 days to schizophreniform disorder. And as near as I can tell, the distinction between schizophrenia and schizophreniform disorder is that you exhibit some or all of the symptoms of schizophrenia, but they last for less than 6 months and hopefully don't recur. And so for me, they haven't. So I guess I'm technically I'm a recovering schizophreniform disorder sufferer. I guess that's what I'd be.
Did they give you medication? Have you tried any of the various mind-altering chemicals that the psychiatric profession...
Yes, I have. I was on a drug called haloperidol for quite some time, and another drug, Cogentin, to deal with the side effects of the haloperidol. I find it really interesting. If you look at a physician's desk reference or the pill guide, that all of the symptoms that haloperidol is designed to treat are also listed as possible side effects of the drug. I also found it interesting that it was manufactured by Eli Lilly Pharmaceutical Company, which had on its board of directors Dan Quayle's grandfather, I believe, and George Bush Sr. And at least in part, my nervous breakdown, or whatever you might want to call it, in 1991 was a reaction to the Gulf War and the general policies of the Bush administration.
So you were having delusions that these men were trying to control your brain, and then they gave you some drugs manufactured by these men.
What a perfect loop.
It's a beautiful system. I want to read from the piece, this very nice passage. I was the answer to a complex riddle. What do you get when you attempt to synthesize information on the Kennedy assassination, the political writings of Chomsky and Tolstoy, the history of the CIA, interpretations of myth by Joseph Campbell, Jungian psychology, Kabbalah, Judeo-Christian apocrypha, quantum mechanics, relativity theory, chaos theory, Gödelian logic, hyperdimensional geometry, infinite set theory, Zen Buddhism, the fiction of Douglas Adams and Lewis Carroll, the poetry of William Blake's, hidden meanings in the lyrics of the Beatles, Rolling Stones, Pink Floyd, The Who, and Led Zeppelin. I'm glad you mentioned Zepp, because we've delved into that. All into one coherent worldview, and apparently you are the answer to that question. So I'm just going to be real hard on you here and ask you to unpack three of those for us. So just random. If I didn't like them, then I moved on to another one, but semi-random. So, all right, start with Kabbalah. How does that
You know, at the time, I hadn't delved deeply into Kabbalah, and I still haven't delved extraordinarily deeply. I've meddled on the fringes of the Ordo Templi Orientis and the writings of Aleister Crowley. At the time, I was just turning into this informational omnivore of, I really wanted to know what the hell is going on, and the more sources of information that I could gather together. So in a lot of ways, it was like a scene out of Aronsky's Pie, where
I was thinking about that.
He based it all on my life. No, he didn't. But I was beginning to look at things like learning that I'd heard that the first verse of Genesis gave you the mathematical value of pi, and that the whole story of Genesis, where you have the Garden of Eden, which is a paradise, a walled garden, is infinite, eternal, and that the symbol can be utilized as a symbol of infinity or eternity, and that what happens is they eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which creates a binary logic system. So it's reminiscent of drawing the diameter through the circle, which severs the infinite eternal bliss into the worlds of life, death, good, evil, all of the structural divisions which underlie a society. And this is also where some of the Joseph Campbell influence was coming in, of looking at the myths of Judeo-Christian culture with the serpent as the tempter who is coming to say, hey, eat of the apple, try it. And Campbell pointing out in Myths to Live By that the Buddhists have a different variation on this myth, where the Buddha is sitting underneath the tree of life, and the gods, in an attempt to prevent him from reaching enlightenment, to bring up a terrible storm to move him away, and a serpent crawls up and wraps itself around the Buddha, a cobra, and covers his head with its flaring
hood.
And so you have this very ancient story of the serpent that has different reworkings, and so this was some of what was going on in my head. And I was reading Gödel-Escher Bach at that time, and trying to figure out the foundations of logic, because I felt, you know, there's something wrong with Aristotelian logic of dividing everything into good and evil and black and white. And by the time I got to, as I mentioned in the column that you've just read the excerpt from, and that one's going to be published in the next issue, it's part two. By the end of it, I believed that God was talking to me in newspapers and magazines and television commercials, and there were a lot of bizarre synchronicities that were occurring. It was as if I was on acid for about a month prior to going into the hospital. And, you know, I dabbled in acid and mushrooms, and my parents will still say it was the drugs. But I think looking at infinite set theory and hyperdimensional geometry probably had as much to do with it as anything else. And I went to a party about 2 days before I was hospitalized, and I walked into the bathroom, and I'd been studying Zen Buddhism, of course, at the time. And walk into this bathroom, a house I've never been in before, and they've got a light switch, the dual switch panel. And as I flick on the light, I notice that the one that I've flicked on, it's labeled enlightenment in the on position. It's not labeled at all in the off position. And then the other light switch is labeled life in the on position and death in the off position. And so I found that rather interesting, and I'm flicking the life-death switch on and off, and I'm noticing it does absolutely nothing to the light. And then I flick off the enlightenment switch, and of course I'm in the dark, so it makes sense that it's not labeled because I couldn't read it at all. And so I'd come to a point in my life where I could no longer distinguish between dream, reality, imagination, life, death, good, evil, any of the binary constructs that hold us all together as societies. And I really, the distinction between sanity and insanity became meaningless to me. And it finally hit. I should have mentioned the fiction of Robert Anton Wilson in there as well, that someone had turned me on to Illuminatus. And I think this was prior to the party incident, but I got about two-thirds of the way through, and I hit this one page where I suddenly realized Robin Hitchcock is right. I am a flesh cartoon. I'm a cartoon character in an imaginary universe, and nothing is real. And if it's all just this gigantic four-dimensional movie, I'm going to create a commercial for world peace. And
You came to that one, huh? So 1968. Next thing you know, you'll be marrying Yoko Ono. But that may bring us to the question. The other one, see, there's a big synchronicity here because I'm just getting chills because I picked out the Beatles. Ooh, as among the three things that you might unpack for us. This sounds great. What was unpleasant about it? Why did you end up? I mean, it reminds me of how I felt in periods of my life when I was smoking DMT. Life was, I was a cartoon character in a, weird hyper-dimensional universe. And for me at the time, it was entirely pleasant, actually. But
that was a building euphoria. That was wonderful. But then when I went about just following stream of consciousness logic, so that I'd have Beatles songs running through my head, and like. Dig it, and she came in through the bathroom window, and so I had a task to perform for my friend the day I was institutionalized, where I was supposed to let out his dog three times. He was off with his father looking at World War II bomber planes, and of course I'd been reading Catch-22 as well with Yusarian, who's trying to prove that he's insane so he can get out of the war. And she came in through the bathroom window, and dig it, I'm standing on top of his roof with a shovel attempting to bash in the bathroom window to let the dog out. And, of course, dog is God spelled backwards. And for me, it's all a Gnostic quest now that we have to release the inner divinity from the shells of our bodies, our houses. And I'm looking down at these two garbage can lids below me, a black one and a blue one, and realizing, if I swing this shovel into the bathroom window, I'm going to fall off the roof and bruise myself black and blue. But then I remembered that, it was my friend Steve who wanted me to let the dog out. And Stephen is the first Christian martyr. It was my confirmation name as a Roman Catholic. And I remembered,
no wonder.
Down at the local pool club, Steve Ditchkoff is the manager of the pool. And, you dig a ditch with a shovel, so I'll just go down to the pool and I'll talk with Steve Ditchkoff and see about how to get this dog out of the house. eventually I come home and I'm soaking wet and barefoot, and my wrist is bleeding from punching through the window to let the dog out, and my shirt is torn to shreds up the back, and I was wearing all black and white that day. I had a white shirt, black pants, black and white bathing suit underneath, and I come home, and I was visiting my parents for the weekend, and they're a little concerned, want me to sit down and talk about some things, and eventually when I'm trying to talk about the connections between the architectural symbolism of the Egyptian pyramids and how it connects with relativity theory, blah 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 blah, just turning into Finnegan's Wake, I begin to realize that people just don't get it, that this is just a dream. We're caught in this horrible dystopic reality of war and poverty, and it's only because we've all accepted these imposed game rules, and we just have to recognize we can wake up from all of this. It's all just a horrible dream. All you have to do is wake up. And I began to see the what Reich would call the character armor that's imposed upon a mass society, that people have been robotized to march in processions leading to a nuclear holocaust. I was seeing visions of New York going up in a nuclear inferno while I'm watching space and time dissolve as I'm sitting on the couch with my parents trying to explain myself. And eventually they called a hospital, and I knew that I had to go because I remember my mom looking at me and saying, "They want you to come tonight." And for me, that was long day's journey into night, that the light has become too bright, and the Christian mythos has the light descending into hell, it has to descend into darkness, and that the place they were taking me, Havenwick Hospital, for me it was the wick of heaven is hell, that's where the burning passions are, and I had to descend into that, and I did. I experienced ego death there. I was blacked out for about 2 or 3 weeks, and here I am, whoever I am.
Wow, that's some story. And if you want to join this guy for some camp this summer.
Summer camp.
We are moving towards the close of this show, and we will be recording a second interview for another show. But why don't you tell people that you're not a complete lunatic and how they can join you at the action training camp.
Well, you're actually going to miss me. I'll be out of town and out of country, but we are having a fundraising action training camp for Anarchy from August 26th to 28th. It's going to be camping in the East Bay with workshops, direct action skills, an obstacle course, an herb walk, self-defense, legal training. We might have some spear throwing. There will be anarchist theory and critique. We might even have a shadow puppet show. So it's basically a bunch of people out camping and doing some fun activities. And we are looking for $20 per person for food and camping. And if you're driving alone, it's a $10 parking fee. Make your reservations as soon as possible.
Wait a second. Anarchists have reservations?
Everyone has reservations.
I have severe reservations.
And you can send off your checks made payable to CAL Press, and send that off to CAL Press-Reservation at P.O. Box 3448 in Berkeley, California, 94703. And I probably ought to mention our URL right now, too, if people want to look up, this up on the web. That's www.anarchymag.com. ANARCHYMAG.org.
And it's a great magazine, actually. I mean, I've been reading Anarchy forever. They always used to severely criticize all of my publications for being decadent and insincere and unrighteous. And I swear by that to this day, I remain decadent, insincere, and unrighteous.
You're proud of it.
Thank you for coming in, Ben Blue, and thank you for sticking around for another interview as soon as we pretend it's another day.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Are You Serious Show on MondoGlobo.net. We'd like to thank Ben Blue for joining us. Our gang of three today was Are You Serious, Diana Brown, and myself, Jeff Deal. The music was Sewing Up Crap by Chumbawamba. Next week, our guests will be Mark Fraunfelder, founder of BoingBoing.net and author of World's Worst, a guide to the most disgusting, hideous, inept, and dangerous people, places, and things on Earth. This has been the Are You Serious Show. Don't be afraid of the dark.